And welcome to this edition of the Healthy Planet radio program as part of Natural Alternatives. My name is Bob DiBenedetto, your host for what is always, at all times, not just when we're playing this show, but which is always the best hour of your life, the one that's beginning at all times, right now. The Healthy Planet focuses on topics that will help to educate you about the deep connection among all life on Earth and the powerful effects your everyday choices can have on creating a clean, healthy, and compassionate world, which is what all of us want, regardless of our political party, regardless of who we think of ourselves as. It's what we all want. Somehow we've been twisted to believe that we want different things. And that twisting is ruining us. It's ruining us, some individually, and certainly as a united country. What I'm talking about today has nothing to do with partisan politics. I don't care what party you're with. I will call you out regardless of your party. I've been doing jury duty for the first time in my life, and it is really interesting. And it is instructive in ways, because I'm looking at a system that's obviously been carefully developed over the course of a long period of time, hundreds or thousands of years. And it's very careful. It gets those 12 jurors sitting there, watching a case, listening to every detail, not talking to other people to say, what do you think about this? Not having talk show hosts like myself interpret reality for you, but just listening to the facts, which enables you to come back and make some kind of judgment about what's true and what's not true. And then you have to make a very weighty decision about whether or not you believe in this enough to impact the life of the person who's being tried. That's a weighty decision. It's a very mature process. I like it. And then I think about what's going on our planet. And specifically, the topic of tonight is climate change. And I think about how it's not just one person whose fate is at risk. It's an entire planet. Not just an entire planet right now, but an entire planet now and going forward, centuries and who knows how long. Right now, what we do right now is going to determine whether or not it's possible to move forward without leaving a horrible legacy to future generations. This is a time-sensitive issue. And yet, unlike the jury process, I think our form of government is immature. And I think because they never guessed that such a thing could be happening as it is today. They never guessed that the fate of the planet now and for future generations could be in our hands, because technology was nowhere near in a place back then where they could impact the entire planet for future generations. We're at a place where we're dealing with very powerful technology, but we as a species have not matured fully. And we're certainly not capable of handling the responsibility that's upon us. When people think about climate change, when I talk to people about climate change, often they will respond to me with something about their political party. This has nothing to do with political parties. But somehow, we've mistaken personal commentary and agendas for the truth. Somehow. It's really weird. I have thoughts about how we got here, but I won't go into that now. The fact is, you get some person listening to Rush Limbaugh or Sean Hannity or any of those talk show hosts that have no clue about what they're talking about. And they make statements that are entirely untrue. And somehow I hear a lot of them when I tune in. Entirely untrue or based upon something that's irrelevant or a cherry-picked fact, something that's not supported by all the science, and all of the people listening to them will accept that information as being more credible than the information that our best scientists on our planet are putting out with a very, very strong warning. How did this happen? How did we give the power to these people who have proven themselves to be not only irresponsible, because it's irresponsible to not research what you're talking about, but they are downright misleading the public. Now, I can blame those talk show hosts, and I don't know what their agenda is. I can go into that theory too, but not today. But then when it comes to our politicians, my goodness, the best term I've heard this week is inept white men. Is it inept or unqualified white men? Suffice it to say, we've grown into the system. Now, I have nothing against white men. Let me just put it out there right now. If I'm offending any of you white men, I'm one of you, okay? All I'm saying is that that's not a qualification for you to be in office. Our politicians have blown it. And I could talk about subjective opinions by looking at politics. I can do that, but I'm not. I'm going to stick with the objective. They are not leaders. They have taken scientific information, which is absolutely clear, and they have acted like wimps. Because what a leader is supposed to do, and tell me if you disagree, a leader is supposed to lead. And by leading, you look to at the big picture with wisdom and knowledge and clear judgment, like you would if you were on a jury. And you make a choice for all humanity, especially you're leading in a government like America. We are so powerful today. That's what a leader does. But we've got people in our Senate, in our government, people running for president who are unfit because they can't take the most simple, most clearly thought out scientific facts and give that back to the people because they're afraid of their own careers. And they're willing to risk untold suffering. Now, that's what this show is about. So we don't have leaders today, okay? These people need to go. And for those of you who think I'm attacking Republicans, no, it's not Republicans. I'd be on you regardless of what party you came from. And I'll give you an example of that. Amy Klobuchar, in the last couple of weeks, said something about natural gas being a good fuel for the interim to help us get off of fossil fuels. No, Amy, it's not a good fuel. But Amy, I'll tell you what. If you take back that statement, do your research, ask some experts, understand that that statement you made is ridiculous in today's world. Apologize for it. Come back and show us that you've got some integrity. I'm not saying you don't. You may be misled, but I don't know whether I should give you the benefit of the doubt for that. Maybe you're just trying to get voters. Maybe you're just trying to get power. I don't know. All I know is that what you said was incorrect, and it is beneath someone of your stature to be saying it in the year 2020. Has nothing to do with party. Donald Trump, let's not even go there. If there was a crime against humanity's category, and I can't imagine why there isn't such a thing. We're able to try people for wrongdoings and for crimes, but we can't try leaders for doing much greater harms that are objectively true. Have a trial. Have all the best experts there. Have a nonpartisan, a jury judging the outcome. And we'll find that what the climate scientists are saying is proven and done. Now, this is a show you need to get your friends to listen to. Within the next couple of minutes, we're going to have someone on by the name of Dar Jamal. He is the author of The End of Ice. If you haven't heard him before, please, please listen. This is no joke. And for me, I'm about as upbeat and positive a person as you'll meet. The information that I'm hearing from Dar Jamal is downright depressing. Now, depressing, I don't like being depressed just for the sake of being depressed, but I like to know what's ahead of me. I like to hear interpretations that give us some reality to what we might be facing as a race. And so that's what you're going to get in the next 45 minutes, okay? Stay with me. This is Bob DiBenedetto. WUSB 90.1 FM will be back momentarily.
Finally gotten your attention? Well, it's not just about pleasantly balmy winters. Other impacts include disruption of our food supply, hunger, warm climate pest infestations, rising sea waters, resulting in displacement of millions, and much more. You don't need to wait for the government to act to change the dangerous course that the vast majority of scientists say we're on. Healthy Planet is a non-profit organization that teaches that many of the world's most daunting health and environmental problems have their solution in the choices we make every day. One of the most important actions you can take to reduce global warming gases is to eat lower on the food chain. That's right, less meat equals less pollution. In fact, a new UN report states that livestock production is a greater source of global warming gases than transportation, as well as being a leading cause of water pollution and a loss of biodiversity in the world. And reducing your meat consumption can pay you back personally, with reduced risks of cardiovascular disease, diabetes, and cancer, to name a few. For more on this, and to attend Healthy Planet's popular educational and social events, call them at 631-421-5591 or visit them on the web at www.healthy-planet.org.
And welcome back to the Healthy Planet radio program on WUSB 90.1 FM. So, following up, continuing with what I was saying, here we are in a world where in the last 5 years, we're experiencing the warmest years in recorded history, as were the last 10 years. And the 19 hottest years on record have all occurred in the last 20 years. Sea level rise is now noticeable. Extreme storms are regularly more extreme. Ice is clearly melting. Sea level rise is accelerating. And huge areas of California, Siberia, Australia, and elsewhere have gone up in flames. If any of this makes you angry, if any of this makes you upset, if any of this makes you feel despair, I understand that. And that's part of what this show is about. Because that is normal. That is what we ought to be feeling at such a time. We're experiencing something that has never before happened. Emotions are okay in this context. But we're going to go to our guest, who is an award-winning journalist and author of several books, including his latest book, The End of Ice, Bearing Witness and Finding Meaning in the Path of Climate Disruption, to talk about all of this. And I think you will agree with me once you hear this show, even if you've heard all of my other shows, we've done many on climate change, that this is a unique perspective. His book was included in Smithsonian Magazine's Top Best Science Books of 2019 and a Publisher's Weekly Top 10 Science Picks. In late 2003, wary of the overall failure of the U.S. media to accurately report on the realities of the war in Iraq for the Iraqi people, Dar Jamal went to the Middle East to report on the war himself, where he spent more than 1 year in Iraq as one of the only few independent U.S. journalists in the country. He also reported from Syria, Lebanon, Turkey, and Jordan. But now his focus has shifted to anthropogenic climate disruption and the environment. And for those of you who don't know what that is, anthropogenic means related to human activities. Dar's stories have been published in a variety of world publications, too long to list. He's currently, and has been, a feature writer for truthout.org for 5 years. And his climate feature page there is titled Climate Disruption Dispatches. I'd recommend going there, truthout.org. His writing has been translated into French, Polish, German, Dutch, Spanish, Japanese, Portuguese, Chinese, Arabic, and Turkish. On radio as well as television, Dar has reported for Democracy Now!, which just finished on this station, and Al Jazeera, and has appeared on the BBC, NPR, and numerous other stations around the globe. Dar's reporting has earned him awards which are way too numerous to list here. Suffice it to say that the journalism community has recognized his works over and over again as being valuable. Welcome to The Healthy Planet, Dar.
Well, thank you very much, Bob. Good to be with you.
All right. Now, you've added something unique to my perspective on climate change, and I think part of that comes from the way that you have done journalism. And that is, you've put your body in the places that are at the epicenter of the stories that you're covering. You did it in Iraq, and when you turned your attention to climate change, you traveled the globe to critical ecosystems around the world that matter. And you didn't just travel to the places. You climbed the mountains, you dove in the waters, you touched the coral and lived in the forest. And I used to study Tom Brown, the nature observation and tracking. And he used to say something. He used to say things about when you get into nature, get into it. Don't just look at it, but sink knee deep in the primal ooze. And I get that's what you do. And the result of your immersion into the subject of your journalism has created some absolutely powerful materials. So I'd like you to start out by talking about how you got started on this path of doing journalism this way and what this method has yielded compared to, say, searching the web and writing about that.
Well, it really started during the buildup to the war in Iraq, watching the just blatant propaganda, you know, literally the invasion and decimation of a country based completely on lies. I mean, it was a power grab. It was an oil grab. And watching the corporate press do this, the best thing I could come up with to do, since clearly the demonstrations and doing everything we could within this country to try to pressure the government to do otherwise, I felt like this was an information crisis and that people needed better, honest, more heartfelt journalism from the front lines. And so I literally figured out how to go into Iraq and just start writing about how this was impacting the Iraqi people.
And some of that is pretty disturbing, by the way. And how many people died in Iraq?
Well, depending on which measurements you go with, there's a pretty big disparity. The Lancet medical study that came out in 2006 at that time was the most accurate, and that one estimated upwards of 655,000. And since then, of course, bloodshed has continued. So I think it's safe to say over a million people have died as a result, directly or indirectly, as a result of the U.S. occupation.
Most people are unaware of that. All right, continue.
So that really, that formula of just putting myself out on the front lines and trying to write as honestly and clearly and viscerally as I could about what was happening in order to reach the reader on that level, I basically took that template and applied it to the climate crisis and decided the best thing I could do to try to really service the information in this way, to give it to people in a way that they could really take it in both intellectually as well as in their hearts, was to go out to the front lines, places like the Amazon rainforest, the Great Barrier Reef in Australia, Denali up in Alaska, and numerous other places, and go there with scientists who are leading experts studying those things, and then write about it in a way that I'm really trying to reach people to say, hey, look, this is this one amazing, magnificent planet that we live on, and look at what's happening to it, look at how rapidly it's happening, how quickly it's accelerating, and we need to really, really not just understand that intellectually, but feel that in our bodies.
Yeah. So you're acting as a medium, if you will, by going to these places and translating, because I think one of the issues that we're – I know that you agree with this – is one of the issues that we're facing as a society is that we are disconnected. The air that we feel blowing on our faces, as I've mentioned before, comes out of our air conditioning ducts. The sunlight in the morning comes from the computer screen. The rain that falls upon our head comes from the shower head. So when we think about nature and we think about how we relate to nature, we don't have that perspective. It's missing. It's a missing element from our connectedness with nature.
That's exactly right, and I think that's the core cause of the climate crisis, when industrialized humans basically, we allowed ourselves to be taken away from the planet on which we depend upon for our very lives. And I think in order to work to take care of something and protect it, we have to love it. And that disconnection has been a huge bar from us all really loving the planet the way it deserves and really in a way that's necessary if we're going to really take care of it and at this stage of the game, fight for what's left of it.
Yeah. Now let's start talking about your journey as pertains to your latest book, The End of Ice. And you say that that journey actually started decades ago in Alaska. So talk about how your time in Alaska inspired you to focus your efforts on climate change, what you learned there.
I moved up to Alaska, to Anchorage specifically, in 1996, really drawn up there after having seen Denali up in the Alaska Range and really wanting to get into mountaineering and climbing, which I did straight away, but immediately put me on the front lines of the climate crisis. I wasn't a journalist. I had not been researching the climate crisis, but inevitably being up there, and we all know, and it sounds like probably most of your listeners are acutely aware of the fact that of how the Arctic is warming notably more rapidly than the rest of the planet.
Yeah.
And so going out there and going out to glaciers and being on glacier-clad mountains, as well as the weather patterns up there already being intensely disrupted even back in the mid-1990s, I was slapped in the face with these really radical changes that were already happening in the colder climes. And so that really planted the seed. And then by the end of my war reporting, when I was ready to move on and get into environmental reporting, that seed had always been back there kind of itching me in the back of my mind. And so I knew I wanted to come back to it. So in 2010, I did.
Yeah. So you started out in a place that you loved, and you saw what was happening to that place that you loved. And that made you leave for your journey.
That is precisely what inspired me to do it. It really came from, hey, for me, my favorite place on the planet is Alaska, and specifically up on Denali, and watching the dramatic changes happening up there, glaciers vanishing before our eyes, really crazy weather patterns, no snow in Anchorage on the ground in Christmas some of the years I was up there, and this was even a long time ago. And yeah, I cared about it, and that really was the impetus that inspired me into action and really what brought this book into the forefront of my life.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned glaciers, and I think most of us in the U.S., as a result of our disconnection and also because we don't see a whole lot of them, we think of glaciers as kind of a nice natural structure without much function, something we'd see in a book or it would be at a park. But nothing is really further from the truth. So talk a bit. By the way, our listeners, they are driving home from work. They are come from all backgrounds with all different types of beliefs. They may have just tuned onto the station unintentionally, heard some interesting ideas, and have stuck with us. So we don't know who's listening. And I know it's a mix. But I would like you to talk about what you've learned about the importance of glaciers and about the current state of our world's glaciers, as well as what's predicted in years to come.
Well, aside from the aesthetic value of them, they actually have a spiritual significance to many indigenous cultures around the planet and have for millennia. But they also, from an ecological standpoint, play a critical role in multiple species' survival. So, for example, what I learned in Glacier National Park, spending time there with the lead glaciologist in the park, Dr. Dan Fagry, was, for example, a glacier in a valley will keep that valley a certain temperature. So that means certain animals and certain vegetation are going to live there because of a temperature threshold that exists because of the existence of a glacier that normally would not be able to live there. The streams that come out of the glaciers are going to be very cold, obviously, so there's a certain fish that's going to live there and certain insects. So if you remove that glacier, those things are not going to be there. And then if you remove those things, then the other animals and birds that feed on those are not going to be there and then go on up the food chain, right? Same with trees that grow there and the elevation that those trees can exist if a glacier's there. So literally you're going to talk about an entire different ecology if you remove a glacier. Certainly when we're removing them now, on a human time scale, not a geologic time scale. So all of the flora and fauna that depend on those glaciers in those areas are going away right along with the glaciers. I should say most of it is,
yeah.
Not all.
Yeah.
And then globally, what's very, very distressing and you know, anyone that's paying attention to environmental reporting is seeing basically papers on this just about every week these days, especially with the record high temperature set in Antarctica this week, surpassing the previous high temperature that was set 2 days before that one, where glaciers around the world and ice fields are retreating at record rates. And so at the current trajectory, according to one study I cite in my book, that we are on track to have no functional glaciers within the contiguous 48 United States by 2100. And then equally distressing, the current trends of warming, the Himalaya could possibly be largely free of glaciers by 2100. So what that means for humans from a survivability perspective is one area of the Himalaya is the source of drinking water and irrigation water for upwards of 5 billion people in Asia.
I'm going to repeat that, Dar, because the connection cut out a little bit. In the Himalayas, the glaciers are a critical water store for hundreds of millions, but also they impact about 1.65 billion. I'm not sure how many you said rely on those rivers that flow from the peaks of the Himalayas, Hindu Kush region.
Right, right. 1.5 billion people in that region depend on glaciers for their drinking and irrigation water. And so if you remove that, which right now we are on track to see that ice almost completely gone, if not absolutely completely gone by 2100. So then what people need to think about is not just those 1.5 billion people then are directly impacted. They're going to have to move because humans cannot live in an area where there's no water available. And then think about what that means for the areas where they move. What about the stress on that water supply, food supply, shelter, jobs, economies, et cetera? So see, there are these very troubling cascading effects of what happens when we start to lose the ice.
Yeah, that is beyond troubling. I mean, we're looking at, on our southern border, the societal unrest that has occurred by ramping up the excitement and fear over tens of thousands of people coming over our southern border. And what you're talking about is potentially billions of people needing to move to another country. We don't have...
That's right.
We have no
That's right.
yardstick to measure the impact on our society.
Exactly. And, you know, and that's just talking about impacts from loss of ice sheets and glaciers. And then when we factor in sea level rise, a UN study shows that by 2100, we could see 2 billion global refugees just from sea level rise alone. So factor in those two things together, and we're starting to talk about a science fiction dystopian novel is what we're looking at. And what's very distressing about this is we are very much on track to see that. You know, we consistently see an outpacing of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change's worst-case projections, whether it comes from loss of Arctic sea ice or temperature increases in the atmosphere or the rates of loss of ice around the globe. But on just about every metric, the observational evidence in front of our eyes is currently outpacing what were the worst-case projections back in the 1990s. And this trend, not only is it continuing, but it seems to be accelerating.
Yep, and the news stories just keep coming out day after day. And just when you think you've heard enough for the week, another monumental study comes out that tells us things that are too horrible to even imagine. Now, at this point, considering that I think the problem with our society in America today is that we are bounced back and forth between the world of fact and fiction. And people, I've had discussions with them about climate change, about various things, and they believe that no fact exists. The words of a talk show host who's not quoting fact is the same to them as reading the studies of 10,000 climate scientists. And there's no basis in facts that can sway them because they tend to doubt everything. So with that said, I would like you to just put forth what your standards are in terms of quoting studies or quoting information and how much you reflect the truth in your words as opposed to having heard something that you'll say or put in an article or in a book.
Well, knowing the power of the fossil fuel industry in the United States and the level of misinformation and disinformation going out there, as you just spoke to directly, I knew that this book had to be bulletproof, that the science had to be absolutely top-notch. And so there's 21 pages of citations in the book, and I only cite the most prestigious reports available. So studies produced from entities such as NASA or the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences or other very, very highly esteemed peer-reviewed journals. And so this is why one interesting thing that happened when the book came out is the Smithsonian Magazine actually did a review of the book, and it was a good review, but their one critique was that they said, well, but Jamail seems to always go to the worst-case scenarios. And yet by the end of the same year, and I didn't change a thing in the book, what changed was how fast things are unraveling on the planet. And by the end of last year, just this past December, as you said at the top of the program, the Smithsonian ranked the book as one of their top science books of 2019. And it's also shortlisted for a Penn Literary Award for science writing. So clearly the science is very, very sound. It's been fact-checked repeatedly as well as being up for these very notable awards. And that's simply because I really went to great lengths to make sure that everything that I cited was as scientifically sound as possible.
I appreciate that clarification. That is really important in the world today. So let's stay in the Northern Hemisphere. You've been talking about some of the changes to the Himalayans and the glaciers around the world and what could happen as a result of that. Then there's permafrost. And over the last year, even in the last few weeks, the thawing of the permafrost has been in the news. Now, most people don't even know what permafrost is, much less the implications that it could have to the continuance of human survival on this planet. So describe that permafrost and what's happening in the Arctic. And also with that, the concept of feedback loops.
Yeah, I'm glad you bring up permafrost because I don't think it gets discussed enough.
And it isn't
a
ever,
critical component right here in the climate discussion. And it's essentially frozen tundra up in the Arctic. The Arctic Circle is full of the stuff on land, but it even exists quite far south of that. Even areas just north of Anchorage, Alaska, still have permafrost, even though that's still quite far south of the actual Arctic Circle, to give you an idea of how much area on the planet we're talking about. There is a massive amount of carbon equivalent in the permafrost. We've emitted 850 gigatons of carbon into the atmosphere since the Industrial Revolution began, and there's an estimated 1,450 to 1,850 gigatons of carbon in the permafrost. So we could not just double, we could even add nearly 200% the amount of carbon into the atmosphere as the permafrost thaws. The problem is it is thawing, and it's thawing rapidly. And Dr. Vladimir Romanovsky, I think one of the leading permafrost experts on the planet, who's based out of University of Alaska Fairbanks, told me when I was working on my book that it was thawing and that even by 2050 we could see the top several meters of it basically come above freezing temperatures on a pretty regular basis, which is very distressing information. Even more distressing, just this past fall, as you just mentioned, he was co-author of a study that came out and showed that the permafrost was at that point already, it was melting at a rate it wasn't expected to melt at for another 70 years. Mm. So this is very, very distressing information.
NASA talks about something called abrupt thawing. And what you're talking about is not incremental changes necessarily. It could happen quickly.
That's right. And so that abrupt thawing, and that goes right into the feedback loops that you wanted to discuss a little bit, where these feedback loops are compounding upon themselves. So one feedback loop, to use permafrost as an example, is it's storing all of this organic carbon. Well, as it reaches above freezing temperature, then it's releasing that CO2 and small bits of methane up into the atmosphere, which then warms the atmosphere faster, which causes more of it to thaw, which releases more of it, and so it goes. A simple way to describe a feedback loop, one of the scientists told me, is simply the more something happens, the more it happens. And so then not just that on itself, but then that feedback loop on top of the reduction of the Arctic summer sea ice, on top of more than several dozen other feedback loops that have already kicked in. And it's the aggregate of those together when they're compounded upon each other. As Dr. Dan Fagry, who I mentioned earlier, he said that's the thing that worries him the most is all of these together are producing changes that even climate models cannot keep up with. And what you just mentioned with this abrupt thawing, this is what we're seeing now. This is why, for example, in the Antarctic, literally in this 1 week alone, we saw two record high temperatures in the place that's supposed to be the last area left untouched by the climate crisis.
Yeah. Another one of those big pieces of news. Now, you've been talking about how much sea level rise is baked into the equation already, with some pretty startling statistics about that.
I interviewed Dr. Harold Wanless at University of Miami Coral Gables, one of the leading sea level rise experts on the planet. And to cut to the chase, what he told me was that if you simply look at what happened in the atmosphere as far as CO2 levels with each corresponding glacial and interglacial period in Earth's history, he said every time we went in and out of a glaciation period, we saw a corresponding 100 part per million CO2 difference in the atmosphere. So, for example, right now, that means since we've added roughly 136 parts per million CO2 to the atmosphere since the Industrial Revolution began, I said, look, so does that mean that we have 136 feet of sea level rise basically essentially already baked into the system since that CO2 is already in the atmosphere? And he said, yes, that's what that means. And so essentially we've already done the injury to the planet in that so much CO2 is in the atmosphere right now, and 93.4% of the heat we've added to the atmospheres has been absorbed into the oceans, half of that since just 1997. And as I asked him, you know, what do you say about the people that say, hey, we can mitigate this or stop it or turn it around or reverse it? And he says simply the question, how are you going to remove that heat from the oceans? So when we look at these massive ice sheets in the Antarctic melting from below, we just saw the Pine Island Glacier release another stunningly huge iceberg just earlier this week.
Yeah.
You cannot reverse that. And so we have to then grapple with coming to terms with the fact that we've got a massive amount of warming now baked into the system no matter what we do.
I describe this frequently in my talks as similar to what happens to boiling pasta, cooking pasta on a gas stove. You turn down the flame as the bubbles are rising when you've waited too long. And even if you turn the flame off, those bubbles are going to continue to rise over the top and cause a mess. And that's where you're saying we are now, to the point of us having baked into that rising bubble pot of water 130 feet of sea level rise. It's, again, unfathomable.
It really is. It means essentially the removal from existence of every major coastal city on the planet. And he also cited, he being Dr. Wanless, cited a study co-authored by Dr. James Hansen, formerly of NASA Goddard Space Studies Program, that showed, based on paleo records, it's not out of the realm of possibility we could even see a 10-foot sea level rise by just 2050. As these different feedback loops are compounding upon themselves.
Yeah, we saw a study come out probably in the last few months that said that the projections for sea level rise had been not applied properly because they were not looking at the surface of the Earth at the proper level. They were taking the tops of the trees. They weren't taking into account the actual level of the lands. And as a result, they showed maps of what they were considering to be possible by 2030, 2050. And we're talking about large portions of, say, southern Vietnam being underwater by 2050. Now, that's tomorrow, and a lot of other cities, large portions of them. So it's not something that we're going to have to wait 50, 100 years for. We're talking about in the very near term.
That's exactly right. And then I would encourage people, when we hear information like that, just like when we were discussing the impact of the loss of ice on 1.5 billion people in the Himalaya region of Asia, which is a huge region, obviously. Correspondingly, when we talk about the possibility of the UN report that I cited saying we could see 2 billion climate refugees just from sea level rise alone, again, so all those people move inland. So what happens at the places where they move as far as water, food availability, jobs, shelter, et cetera? Again, that's where we have to start thinking about these cascading effects of all these things that we're talking about.
Yeah. Yeah. Again, it's hard to think of because the implications are so huge and we have no way of relating to it. And people don't like to think of Armageddon type of situations, thinking that anybody who thinks that we could be going in that direction think that that's the machinations of an extreme mind. But in fact, it's what our science is telling us. So we're in a situation where we've got to start dealing with some very unpleasant but real truths and start talking about them with a level head, but also stating them without being afraid of stating them.
That's exactly right. And I've been accused at times of being, too pessimistic or cynical, when literally it's kind of a shoot the messenger kind of experience, when all I'm doing is literally citing different scientific studies and quoting leading experts that I've personally interviewed on these different topics. And as you said, I think that's a point that I want to underscore. It's very important for us to have an accurate map of reality, because only then can we start making the very important decisions each one of us needs to be making for our lives. Does it make sense to be acting as though things are going to go on forever, when in reality we need to start bracing ourselves and taking adaptation steps in our own lives, as well as preparing future generations of children, those who are already on the planet and those who are going to come, to try to set them up in a way where they're going to have a chance of existing on a dramatically changed planet.
Yep, knowledge is power. And it's good to know what's coming your way. I've done talks for many years in schools, and some parents actually would say to me, I'd rather not know. When we were talking about, hey, look, these things cause heart disease, stroke, cancers, diabetes, I'd rather not know. And then he say, well, what about your kids? Would you rather know for them? So it's an inclination to not want to know the bad news. But once you know it, at least you can either adapt or get ready for what's coming. So let's switch now to your journey to the Amazon forest before we get into some of the how to deal with this, which we'll talk about momentarily. For many who have not been there, it's just another forest. And again, it's conceptual. It's a beautiful place, but it doesn't mean anything to me. But what you get across is just how unique and central it is to our planet's health. So take a couple of minutes to describe the importance of this ecosystem and your experiences of the forest and what you learned in your interactions at Camp 41.
Well, I was very privileged to get to go to the Amazon with Dr. Thomas Lovejoy, who's often referred to as the godfather of biodiversity, and Camp 41 being the most famous of his study camps. And just a little bit about the Amazon, it's two-thirds the size of the contiguous United States. It's the largest rainforest on the planet. It generates half its own rainfall and contains 20% of the world's rivers. The Amazon River alone has 1,100 tributaries, 17 of those longer than 1,000 miles apiece. There's thousands of species of trees, 2.5 million species of insects, and thousands of species of birds. It is by far and away the single most biodiverse place on the planet. And it's absolutely critical as far as how much carbon it sequesters as well. But what's very distressing now, and everyone's listening is, I'm sure, at least caught a little bit of news about the dramatic escalation in fires there this past summer. But even before that happened, a drought there in 2010 caused the Amazon to release as much CO2 as the total annual emissions of Russia and China combined. And we are as we speak, losing 1.5 acres of rainforest around the planet every second. And this is a really important issue because of the role the Amazon plays in sequestering carbon from the atmosphere. Well, it can't do that if it's in drought or burning up or being deforested, and that's exactly what's happening now. The climate impacts alone of the drought and the increasing number of wildfires, and then factor in someone like Bolsonaro down in Brazil, who's actively engaging in the acceleration of the deforestation that's happening. They're chopping it down as fast as they can to put in pastures for beef cattle. And you put these things together, and it's a perfect storm where the Amazon is now under threat of coming up to a critical tipping point, which Dr. Thomas Lovejoy has warned about. He said, look, once we lose roughly a quarter of the Amazon area, then that's probably a tipping point where the entire rest of the rainforest shifts, collapses, and turns into savanna. So all that sequestered carbon then goes back up into the atmosphere.
It's one piece of bad news after another. Let's shift now, because all of this information is objectively sad and a lot more. And usually in this point at our show, we talk about solutions and can hopefully turn the problems that we are outlining on the shows around. In this case, however, what you're offering up is not easy solutions, but thoughts on how to live in the context of global collapse. And that's a weighty topic. You know, obviously, this is our life support system. This is our planet, our only one. And the last chapter of your book, The End of Ice, deals with this topic and is entitled, How Shall We Live? So talk about how your thoughts on how to live with the possibility that our Earth is dying.
Yes, after going around to places and having an experience at the Amazon that I just gave one broad brushstroke of, but I had comparable experiences with the Great Barrier Reef in Australia, which, you know, coral experts in Australia said it's going to be gone by 2030, to glaciers in Alaska that I used to climb on that are long gone, that don't even exist anymore, and those experiences repeated over and over and over. I mean, I got to the end of the book and frankly, like, how the hell do I end this? I don't know what to do with this. I was like climate scientists. I was struggling with despair and depression. And I had to basically start digging deep just to find a way myself, like, well, you know, okay, where do we go from here and what do we do with this? And so I realized that kind of it felt like a lie to try to pretend to like have hope or encourage people to have hope. And I realized that I had to kind of dive into addressing that in the book, which I did, kind of the hope versus hopelessness paradigm, which I learned was really a false paradigm. And we need to start learning to live hope-free, which I have found a lot of liberation in that, because it really brings me very into the present tense moment, which is, okay, I have a moral obligation, no matter how dire things appear to be, I have a moral obligation to get up each day and kind of take a more indigenous perspective, which is I have two primary obligations: to serve the planet the best way I can and take care of it, and the second one, to serve and take care of future generations of not just humans, but all species. And so when I get up each day and I really think about what I'm going to do within that frame of how to serve the Earth and how to serve future generations, then it becomes less important about what are the results of my actions going to be long term. And what's more important is what can I do today to try to be of service to these very, very important things. Another quote that I came across along those lines that really helped me a lot came from Czech dissident writer and statesman Václav Havel, who said, "Hope is not the conviction that something will turn out well, but the certainty that something is worth doing, no matter how it turns out."
Yep, this is worth doing. This is an objectively frightening topic, beyond any kind of horror movie or other scary movie that we might see. However, you state that you're not writing about it from a place of fear-mongering.
No, it's simply been literally reporting the facts from the front lines of the climate crisis, which, you know, I went to great pain to make sure that all the science in the book was extremely sound, and some of the acknowledgments the book has received since it came out a little over a year ago, I think, are great testimony to the lengths that myself and my editors went to make sure it was essentially scientifically bulletproof, which I feel very confident that it was when it was written. And if anything now, given how rapidly everything's accelerating on the planet, climate-wise, if anything, I think the book could have even gone further as far as including in some of the more dire predictions that some of the scientists I spoke with made, which we actually made a choice not to include. So it's very, very sound. And again, it comes back to, we have to really understand the reality that we're in order to make the right decisions about how we're going to live our lives. And another thing that I like to point out to people is sort of a thought experiment, is to imagine, okay, knowing all of the data that we just talked about on the show and how rapidly things are unraveling on the planet, fast forward and imagine yourself on your deathbed, you know, however many years that is into the future. And then imagine someone from a younger generation comes up to you, a young child, and says, "Wow, you were alive in 2020. Did you know what was happening to the planet with the climate crisis?" And of course, we're all going to have to say, "Yes, we did." And then their next question naturally would be, so what did you do? And I think that's a really important thing for us to think about right now. What are we going to be able to say that we did in the future? As things get worse and worse, we lose more parts of the ecosystem, more species, and things continue to unravel. What are we going to be able to say we did to try to fight to mitigate the situation and take adaptation preparation measures?
Yeah. All we can do is all we can do. And that's what I'm committed to doing. All I can do. And that's all I can do. So here we go. And I'm ever expanding what I think is possible in that sense. I attended a workshop a few weeks back that was entitled Living the Crisis. And this event acknowledged that we experience complex feelings in response to this climate change crisis disruption. And the day provided an opportunity to address those feelings and see them as an opportunity. And one of those feelings that comes out of this information is obviously grief. And then the other day, I received an email from the Climate Reality Project talking about dealing with climate anxiety. So this is starting to happen now. There's more discussion among the environmental groups and people who are looking out for the emotional welfare of our population to talk about the feelings that are coming out of this topic and all the difficult information. So talk about the role of grief and other emotions in dealing with this bleak situation for you.
Yeah, it's very heartening to me as well to see how much attention grief and eco anxiety and all of these topics are getting in the media, as well as even courses now being taught in colleges, preparing people on how to deal with this, as well as to help children deal with it, as well as workshops and other types of things, because it's very, very real. And even some of the leading psychological and psychiatric bodies in the U.S. are acknowledging eco anxiety is a huge thing around with children. And just in this last week alone, I believe it was Sunday, both the Washington Post and the Guardian both ran very excellent articles about eco anxiety and the youth growing up today and how real and how pervasive it is. And I'm seeing that personally, too, with younger people in my life. And so I think it just underscores the fact that it's only human to have deep feelings and despair, anger, frustration, apathy, anxiety, rage, sadness about all of this that we're talking about and all of this that we're witnessing. And what I found personally is I cannot see clearly and have the capacity to act rightly about what's going on until I let myself cycle through those feelings. And so that means we're getting psychological here, but that means, you know, having people I can talk with about it and other ways to deal with these feelings and then let those flow through and then come out the other side and say, okay, here we are. We're still here. What are we going to do today? And that's become this really ongoing process in my life that I have to do on a pretty regular basis because I'm looking at this stuff every day, square in the eye. I'm still writing about it, working on other projects that address it. And it's very, very hard. So it is an ongoing process. And but that's really the only healthy way to kind of stay with this information and still be able to be taking the right actions on a daily basis.
Yeah. Yeah, I had attended a lot of meditation retreats over the course of my life. And I remember one of the ways that they described dealing with what comes up during meditation is if it keeps pounding at the front door, whatever it is, it could be anger, it could be fear, it could be tiredness, it could be any kind of emotions or something that's taking your mind away from focusing on what is happening in the moment. Don't just keep the door closed. If they keep knocking on the door, open the door, welcome them in, and open the back door. And I think that's kind of what we're getting at here, is that you don't get rid of something by ignoring it.
Right. I mean, it's the only way through it is through it.
Yeah. And it's been said that the only constant is change. And you can take that on the surface level and say, yeah, that's true. Only constant is change. But that truth is more apparent to those who've had some kind of meditation practice where that constant arising and passing away is clearly noticeable and clearly noticeable as the fabric that forms the context of our life. You've been a meditator, which makes sense, since much like diving into the waters of the Great Barrier Reef or climbing mountains or putting yourself at the center of the Iraq War, meditation is the way to immerse oneself into the experience with each moment of our lives. And if anyone has not meditated, I strongly recommend it, highly recommend it, because it'll show you things about your experience of your life that you have no way of accessing without getting quiet. So talk about how meditation has helped you to cope with what is just plain out disturbing.
Well, we're daily barraged with so much negative, intense information. I mean, I really believe that the second someone opens their browser and goes to a news site on any given day, you're going to be experiencing trauma, whether it's the domestic political crisis in the U.S., or the climate unraveling, or violence around the world, economic disparity. I mean, you know, pick a topic. We're just besieged daily. And I think it's so easy for all of us to feel completely overwhelmed by these converging crises. And for me, sitting on a regular basis, start out the day grounded on the planet, like literally, you know, sitting on the planet, being very, very quiet and kind of starting the day, and I am a novice meditator at best. I've never had any kind of formal training or anything like this, but I've simply found that when I do it, I can go through the day and maintain a much more even keel. And when I don't do it, I end up getting kind of caught up in the whirlwinds of the various crises and all the emotions that go with them.
Right. Yep. Yep. It does ground you. It is often talked about as a grounding practice. And the fact that you're on the ground has something to do with it. But the fact that you are just getting in touch with what's real, you know, meditation is getting in touch with what's real without not what's imagined in the future or what trailing thoughts have come from the past, but it has you dealing with what's real in the moment. So again, highly recommended. Now, if we're doing all that we can do, and again, as I said, all we can do is all we can do. I'm going to take just this moment to reiterate what we've said so many other times, that there are some large actions that you can take that really do have an impact. And as a part of the collective, they have a big impact. We've been seeing, Dara, I'm really happy to see that you've taken on the, I heard you speak recently, taken on the challenge to take meat out of your diet, because we've been learning more and more about that topic and just how closely related our overconsumption of animal products that waste so many resources, that takes so many resources, that use so much of our agricultural lands while providing a minuscule portion of our calories, how getting off of that is a big first step. You know, other things for people on Long Island are things like putting solar panels on your house, putting geothermal in your house, getting a home energy audit. Any homeowner is using a lot of energy on their home. Get an audit. Make your house a couple of times more efficient. Lower our personal carbon footprints. Stop the impacts that you're having on the planet yourself. And I know that while you're not looking at that as the solution that's going to fix the world, it is something that you focus on, taking personal actions.
Well, all of that are great examples of how it comes back to that moral responsibility. And again, like, how are we going to answer to future generations? Are we going to be able to say, yes, I did everything I could personally and professionally to try to deal with this and take care of the planet and do less harm and prepare future generations for what's coming and this new world they're going to be living in? And it comes down to a yes or no answer. And so everything you just put out there are just great examples of, you know, these are just some of, from my perspective, some of the very, very basic things that any and all of us can start doing today.
Yeah, they're very basic and simple. A lot of them are simple. You know, certainly what you eat at your next meal is simple. It doesn't require any extra cost. It doesn't require any equipment. So it's something we can dive into like that, which is what I love so much about that aspect of the solution. And then, of course, the other things are appropriate when it is appropriate for you. You know, getting an electric car. Not everybody's buying a car now. I can't say spend your last $10,000 on a used electric car. It's just not for everybody right now. But whatever we can do, we need to do. Dar, any final thoughts on any of this, the situation that we're dealing with, or anything else on your mind?
Well, just really to reiterate, I think, a core thing that I've been coming back to recently is that it's very, very easy to fall into despair, depression, or even apathy about this because the topic is so utterly overwhelming. And what I found is just to reiterate one of the things that Greta Thunberg has said, which is action is the antidote to despair, where literally just make, you know, getting up, get, you know, what am I doing? How am I being of service? What else can I do? And just making myself sometimes take the action, even if I really don't feel like it, because, you know, it's so easy to get caught up in the emotions and let them run everything. But, you know, obviously what we discuss, you know, the importance of having them, but then coming out the other side is to really keep taking the appropriate action on a daily basis. And when I do that, I keep running into other people doing really, really great work and finding inspiration and motivation to keep doing it and taking heart in the fact that there's, you know, it's so easy to feel isolated, like, oh, maybe you or your one small group or some of the only ones really taking a lot of action, but taking heart in the fact that there's literally tens of millions of people, if not hundreds of millions of people around the world daily taking on this task of, okay, how can we try to do better mitigation and adaptation for what's happening?
Absolutely. And just as a reminder to you, I know you've been steeped in this for so long and that it's, sometimes it's hard to get a sense of the impact that you're having. And I just want to reconfirm with you, you're having an impact because a lot of people like myself who have been doing this work for decades and who are involved in creating some kind of outreach that's going to be as effective as we can imagine, we take strength from hearing people like you who bring this information to us. So thank you for that.
Oh, that gives me heart. I really appreciate that. Thank
yeah.
you.
And I will encourage all of you, the rest of you. I know a lot of people who are advocates on Long Island and elsewhere. I know a lot of you. And my urging to you is to take any opportunity you can take to up your game. You're doing it already. Take it up a level. Meet with others. Coordinate with others who are doing the same thing. Create something bigger. Create something more powerful together in any way you can imagine. Use your imagination. Use every resource you have to create something, because all of us need to in a world where we're faced with a catastrophic situation and yet a portion of the world is being entirely misled and given bad information to the point where they think the information you have is false. They really believe that. So it's up to us to up our game. And I'm encouraging all of you individuals and those advocacy people who are already in the game to up the game. So thanks for being with us, Dar. Really appreciate it. Dar Jamel, award-winning journalist and author of several books, including his latest, The End of ICE, Bearing Witness and Finding Meaning in the Path of Climate Disruption. And my name is Bob DiBenedetto. I want to thank you for listening to The Healthy Planet. I'll be with you again on Friday, March 13th at this same time. That's right, at 6 p.m. And I also want to say you to save the date. It's coming up on May 21st, Thursday. Healthy Planet, our nonprofit organization, HealthyPlanetUSA.org, will be featuring Dr. Salish Rao, a author of a number of books, an executive producer of Cowspiracy, and a number of other films. And he's been working on getting people to up their game and to understand the implications of their actions. And we'll be screening one of those films and hosting Dr. Rao live, and that's on May 21st. And for more information on Healthy Planet events, including that one, go onto our website at www.healthyplanetusa.org. Get on our email list for our upcoming events and for our radio shows. Email us at info@healthyplanetusa.org. And look for our Facebook page by looking for Healthy Planet USA. You'll get notified of events, but also you'll be in touch with people who are actively involved in this action, which we all need to be. And of course, when I'm not here, we've got other hosts, excellent hosts that are reaching out, reaching tens of thousands of people every week. We are part of Natural Alternatives. This is the Healthy Planet radio show as part of Natural Alternatives. And we're on every week at this time with great hosts sharing cutting-edge information on health and environmental issues every week at this time. And until next time, I understand this is tough information, but I urge you to stay strong, go through whatever it is you're going through. Since I've been learning about this information, and as you know, I've been focusing on climate change for decades. And as I come upon each piece of both bad and good information, it hits you, you deal with it, you turn it into wisdom, and it comes out the other end in the form of action. That's what we need to all keep doing. Assimilate it, take it in, don't ignore it, share it. Because the more you speak up, the more the world has the opportunity to get on the same page and to understand the power of what's happening on our planet. Even in this world where the political climate is challenging, I know it's hard to speak sometimes. I see a lot of people, I think, not speaking up because it's so divisive. But this is not divisive information. This has nothing to do with differing on political issue. The only difference we have from our political friends on the other side in terms of climate change and the environment is the fact that our leadership has failed us. And one party in particular has been putting out some absolutely wrong information about what's going on. And it's so divisive. But there's no need for that. New leadership in either of these parties can bring us together. So I'll urge you to be kind to those around you, including yourself and our amazing animal friends, and enjoy this beautiful world that we all share. Good night.
I'm on my way, I know I am, somewhere not so far from here. All I know is all I feel right now, I feel the power growing in my hair. Sitting on my own, not by myself, everybody's here with me. I don't need to touch your face to know, I don't need to use my eyes to see. I keep on wondering if I sleep too long. Will I always wake up the same or so? And keep on wondering if I sleep too long. Will I even wake up again? Thank the moon, I had the strength to stop. Oh, I'm not making love to anyone's wishes, only for that light I see. 'Cause when I'm dead and Lord, Lord, in my grave, that's gonna be the only thing that's left of me. And if I make it to the water side, will I even find me a boat? Water side, I'll be sure to write you a note or something. Yo, I'm on my way, I know I am, somewhere not so far from here. All I know is all I feel right now, I feel the power growing in my hair. Oh, life is like a maze of doors, and they all open from the side you're on. Pushing hard, boy, try as you may, you're gonna wind up where you started from. You're gonna wind up where you started from.